you've just explained by way of introduction that the book Divine Providence is the book which I'm going to introduce. So I will be talking to the book Divine Providence quite a lot during my presentation. It has been translated. The one I'm using it to is the one I've had ever since my student days. It's one that's so familiar with me that I pick it up and I can find exactly where I want to be. But also, it just gives me an opportunity to tell you that I personally believe the books should be used. I don't want any of my books left to anybody else. I'll give them away before I die. My books can be burnt because I believe very much in noting, highlighting, working with a book. I don't believe they should be kept in pristine condition and left on the shelf. I just urge that on you. Don't look at your books as if you can't touch them. Look at your books to work with them. Use them, mark them that it is in a way satisfactory to you. Now, you may have seen also the New Century Translation of Divine Providence, which is here. That's been available for about 4 years, and those of us who are doing a lot of practice, some of us at least, are using this particular translation. We're just so fortunate that we've got a lot of new translations coming through at the moment. They're making the books of what we call the writings so much more accessible, so much easier to read. The flow, the use of language in English and even colloquialisms are just excellent. It just means, though, that, you know, in a generation this also is going to need another translation, because I picked up on the colloquialisms in it and realised that they will go out of fashion and new ones will come into fashion. So the translating of the books of the writings is just so important for their freshness, for their accessibility, and for the general reading of them. The book Divine Providence is the companion book of Divine Love and Wisdom, which David introduced this morning. Very simple way to remember those two books, they're meant to be read together, is that Divine Love and Wisdom is the Lord's love, Divine Providence is the Lord's wisdom. Okay? Love and wisdom. Divine Providence is all about wisdom, the way in which the Lord, through love, works in his creation. From love, works into creation. Now, it's probably the book that's been read second to Heaven and Hell. And I guess I didn't find any statistics that the book has probably been made available in more languages like Heaven and Hell has than any other book of writings. That's my take on it. And as an indication, which I think it is, of the way in which within the new church we have struggled with, like people do on the outside world, which I'll show you in a moment, there are a number of books. This is the most recent. This is Why Does God Let It Happen by Bruce Henderson. There is another one written some 20 years ago by Dan Goodenough, Providence and Free Will in Human Actions. There is Peter Buss, a little booklet that's appeared in various formats, Why Did the Lord Let It Happen? There's another Peter Buss, The Lord Cares, and earlier on from Britain, Gold Tried in the Fire, The Use of Suffering. And I don't think this is comprehensive, but it just is an indicator of the way in which Providence has been on the minds of people, and the people have worked and been challenged to translate the teaching in the book Divine Providence into understandable and life situations. Now, the other one is Reflections on Providence. This is a gem. This is by the Reverend Frank Rose, alongside whom Glenn and Mary worked in Tucson, and know them very, very well. It's just terrific. It's broken up into maybe 12 or so lovely little paragraphs, and I asked Michael if he could bring copies of this, and has done, so if you would like a copy of it, it's not expensive, please get it, because it's just a little thing you can read each chapter each night or something like that, or sitting on the bus. It's just fabulous. Now, I have myself risen, whether successfully or not, to the whole thing of translating divine providence for people and for other consumption. And I brought along a course that I prepared for Manchester, for the training of ministers there, and that was a what we call an 8-session course, which I've still got. I write it all together differently now. It's probably 12 years or so, maybe a little bit longer since I wrote it and prepared it and revised it and that sort of thing. But divine providence has also been one of my favourite topics as well. Some of the books I used when I prepared that course, a little bit out of date, is this one called Evil and the God of Love by John Hick. He was a professor at Birmingham University. And there's another one called The Puzzle of Evil by Peter Vardy. And again, they're just a selection of material and books you can get where the whole subject of the Lord's government presence ordering of human affairs, his response to human affairs, are being discussed. I could have bought another one by a Jewish author, Rabbi Kushner, who was quoted, by the way, in Bruce Henderson's book, quoted quite a lot in Bruce Henderson's book, and he actually endorses it as well. There it is here, Rabbi Harold Kushner. He refers to Bruce Henderson's book here as the best consideration of God's role in tragedy from a traditional perspective that I've ever read. Now, I thought, by the way, divine providence and the subject of divine providence is not confined to one book. And if there's one other section in the books of the writings where the topic is, I think, very, very reassuringly and beautifully taken up, it is in Arcana Celestia, and it's around about 8450 to about 8480. There's some wonderful passages, and I don't want to become too personal about this, but it is from that section that I have taken out a quotation which has come to mean a huge amount to Margaret and myself. I carry one in my wallet, I have one on my desk, I have one on my filing cabinet. There are some magnificent statements in there about divine providence that I also highly recommend. Now,
are you
going to
read it?
I was going to say. I will read it to you. It has here, peace has within itself a trust in the Lord, that he is in control of everything and is taking care of everything, and that he's leading toward a good outcome. When we're in this faith, then we are at peace. We're not afraid of anything, no worry about the future disquiets us.
And what's the
8455. Now, just one other thing I want to say in terms of introducing this session. The book Divine Providence is probably the one of, I'll just put it like that, but my experience working with the book Divine Providence has, I think, more than any other book of the writings, helped me grow into, to see, and to work with the Lord. So I really urge that on you. Don't be intimidated by the struggle with the teaching this contains, because as you enter into it, so your eyes are open to the wonder of the operation, the love and wonder of the operation of the Lord. So I see this book as having played continuing to play a wonderful key role. I'm not on top of it, and I don't claim to be on top of it. I'm still wrestling with it in parts. Sometimes I have breakthroughs, and sometimes I feel as if I'm treading through mud. But I still maintain that it has helped to hone my sense of the Lord probably more than any other book of the writings. I read it also, I don't know whether I... Can I just suggest that if you see the book Proving God, you know the book Proving God? Written by
Edward Sully.
He put his hand up to train for the ministry of the General Convention, and quite wisely, knowing his interests, they said, no, don't come to train for ministry. You've got something else to offer. So he went off and he took advanced scientific education and degrees. And he's combined that with his love of the writings and written this amazing book called Proving God. And I've been very fortunate, although I haven't finished reading the book Proving God, I've been very fortunate to have been reading it alongside of my preparation for today's session on Divine Providence. So it's another book I highly recommend. And by the way, it was Philip who not only put me onto that book, but also gave me a copy. I've got lots of handout sheets for this session, so I'll just send these around. While they're being passed around, I just want to explain to you that when the seminar timetable and schedule was being drawn up and I put my hand up for Divine Providence, I quite contentedly thought to myself, that's okay, I'll get in this with a story. And then as I came to really prepare, I backed off. And the reason I backed off is in this little quotation, which most of you have on your refrigerator. Thought from the eye closes the understanding. But thought from the understanding opens the eye. What that is saying to me is this. There is a danger that if you are immersed in, and particularly if you are emotionally involved with some issue to do with the Lord's providence, the likelihood is that you are thinking from the I, trying to move towards understanding, and it doesn't work. Well, that child should never have got cancer, and that blocks you then from getting any further. What that is saying is that we need, if we possibly can, in a non-emotional set of circumstances, to look at the Lord's providence and the way he operates and governs our affairs. And by doing that and exploring that, then we can bring it back into the situations of which we are all of us, aware. So that was my reason not to start with a story. We can all start with it, and we can all I can awaken your emotions very easily by talking about pastoral or other hospital episodes and so on, where the unfairness of life and so on has been smacking your face, and you think, my goodness, how can that be, and why does the Lord let it happen? If I don't say it now, by the way, and I'm thankful for Ruth's Julian, if I don't say it now, I'd want to get it in sometime during this session. Life is not fair. Don't ever expect it to be fair. Okay? The Lord doesn't set out to make life fair. He sets out to enable you to handle what life unfolds for you. That's the important thing. And that was a big breakthrough when some years ago, I remember clearly Julian saying, but life is not meant to be fair. Life is not fair. So when you say, but it is not fair, and I remember him saying, I agree, it is not fair. It's not fair that a child should have cancer at the age of 4 or whatever it is. It's not fair that these things should happen. But the Lord gets in there to enable us to deal with what it is that has arisen in your heart. So I just wanted to make sure I said that. Now, without you looking at those quotations too far, I wanted to just ask you very quickly, if the subject of providence, you asked about the subject of providence, divine providence, just quite quickly, and I won't spend more than a couple of minutes, what is the scripture that comes to mind?
Consider the lilies?
Yep. What else?
The lilies, the stars, yes. God meant it for good.
Where is that, Ben?
Genesis, about 50, somewhere around there, near the end of Genesis.
It's in the New Testament as well. Yeah.
Yep. And do you know where it is in the New Testament? It's in Acts. All things work together for good for those who trust in God.
Yes. Now I was thinking about Joseph saying to his brothers.
Oh, that was it. Yeah, God meant it for good.
Yeah, Joseph said to his brothers, you meant it for evil.
Yeah. Okay, so what other scripture comes to mind?
Job.
Did you say Job and Jonah? What about the 23rd Psalm? What about John 10, where the Lord takes up the shepherd imagery? What else?
There's some in the epistles where said that the Lord will not allow you to suffer more than you can bear.
That's temptation. I've got it marked in my Bible about He will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we can bear. I just put temptation.
Okay. Lay up your riches for heaven, where moth and rust does corrupt.
Yep.
Is that how it's worded? Riches corruption.
Any other?
Dust.
Yep. Psalm 27. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear?
Psalm 27. Psalm 91. No. Psalm 90. What about Deuteronomy? As your days are, so shall your strength be. And the other one is in the same, I think it's chapter 32. I've got it there in your quote about the eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. So there are just some of the scripture quotes. I did not set out to make that exhaustive, but I did set out to let you see that divine providence runs the teaching about, or the subject is touched upon throughout the scriptures. Divine providence. Pardon me?
Isaiah 55.
Isaiah 55.
As the Lord of heaven will accomplish what I will.
Can I be helped then, isn't it? Because the Lord is the word, is divine providence itself.
We know the home now.
Go.
The Bible said, be not afraid, for I'm with you always.
Another one.
A lovely one.
Yes. Is that the Joshua one?
Or is it the resurrection? Is that it?
No, I'm with you always.
Revelation and the age. Yes, I know it.
That's the end of Revelation.
End of Revelation, isn't it?
Yeah. End of Matthew. Mm. I'm with you always. The end of the age is end of Matthew.
Great.
Any others before we move on from there with regard to scripture quotations?
Psalm 127, I think it's except the Lord build the house, and let the Lord build the house, they labor in vain.
The vain beauty is set up in vain. Eat the bread of sorrows.
And then Psalm 121.
I would say
lift up my eyes to the hills.
I just opened it. 121. I was talking to Dan like that one. That was his favorite.
Oh, Anne's come.
And magnificent one. 123. Is 139. Look at it. Who's got 139 in front of them? 139. It is the most explosive statement of the Lord's awareness. That's it. You understand as my thoughts are far. There's not a word on my tongue, but you know it all together. It's amazing, son. You've heard me before. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. Absolutely. I said to you a moment ago that Divine Love and Wisdom, the book Divine Love and Wisdom, and the books Divine Providence are companion volumes. And you'll see as you get into the early chapters, it actually carries on for 20 or 30 paragraphs into Divine Providence, that Swedenborg is referring back to Divine Love and Wisdom. So if you really want to, you can flip back. You know, they really are almost a continuation of the same book. They're published separately, as they were. So there's all this cross referencing, like you've picked up on. It's made up of 18 chapters, and when I said to you that Divine Love and Wisdom is about the Lord's love, Divine Providence is about the Lord's love in action, wisdom, which is the same thing. What I wanted you to hold on to there is that here you have in Divine Love a highlighting of ends or objectives. Here, you know, another way I could have come at it with David this morning was, for me, in summary, Divine Love and Wisdom not only is unfolding the nature of God, but it is telling me what his unending objective in creation is all about. Divine Providence is telling us how he achieves it. Love and wisdom. And that's easily illustrated in our lives. I loaned or gave Glenn some picture books the other day. His love was to get some pictures on the wall of your little house. But he knew that he needed to follow certain rules if those pictures were to be hung successfully. And that's an illustration of what the book Divine Providence is about. How does the Lord successfully achieve his goal with us? That's the book telling you. How does he achieve it? And so subjects such as permission, standing back, going forward with us, all of this is discussed with us in this book, Divine Providence. Hands up those who have read it. Or are reading it. It would be possibly like. You've got the, what they call a portable edition. This is a big edition.
Is it a bigger print or is it?
No, it's got a lot more references in it. Footnotes and footnotes. That's why it's okay. Now, if you haven't read it, there's a few things. I'll give you a few tips. There are three definitions of love which are given in the writings. One is in true Christian religion, another is in divine love and wisdom. It's true Christian religion 43, it's divine love and wisdom 47, but in divine providence 27, there is an equally wonderful definition of love. So that's the first thing that spiritual love, it's the shortest of the definitions. Spiritual love is such that it wishes to give what is its own to another. Almost committed to memory, but that's Divine Providence 27, subsection 2. Still with the highlights of the book, in paragraph 36, if you ever have to refer to them or ever feel that you want to refer to them, it is believed to be the source or the trigger for the whole 12-step program. The Burnham, Chicago New Church family Burnham, the Wilson married into that family and started reading the writings, and he is believed to have got the 12 steps idea from Divine Providence number 36. Just the same as the kindergarten movement has been named from Child's Garden in the book Heaven and Hell. That name is lifted straight out of the German translation of Heaven and Hell. I want to I want to just pick up with you a couple of the highlights more of the book for me. If there's a section in the writings where meditation is discussed, you have a look, you can make the notes. Divine Providence 296, subsection 10. If you want the teaching on the stream of providence, then I urge you to look at Divine Providence 186. That's just magnificent. The stream of providence. Do you feel yourself in the stream of providence? It was put to me in my very early days of coming into the new church, this whole idea of the stream of providence. I wanted to go overseas to train for ordination, and I met obstacle after obstacle. And the elderly new church minister at the time quietly said to me one day, he said, "I don't believe that you're in the stream of providence." And he was right, because a year or 18 months later, things suddenly opened up. And not only did they open up, but I had the opportunity to go to South Africa and work with our Black South African church for nearly 7 months. And that became a life-defining experience for me, which I carry through with me to today. So I've never forgotten that, because when I go bump along the sides of the river, I think to myself, maybe I'm not in the stream of providence. But when I feel as if things are, in a lovely way, just opening up, then I think this is the stream of providence. You know, you're saying this about indicators. Well, I look for indicators like that. I don't look too hard, but I see the contrast at times where I see things working. This is a bit personal, but a few months ago I had to go to a GP for a referral, and I had no intention of going for anything else. But by the time I was walking across the car park, I was clutching my stomach, and I was in real pain. Got to the secretary of the doctor's surgery, and I said, "I've come to see my doctor." And she said, "Oh yes, you're down for 11:30. And she said, "How are you?" I said, "I'm in agony." She said, "Oh, do you want to sit down?" And I said, no, just get me to see the doctor. Well, I was right going off to the shops, because she didn't really realise what was happening. And I I sat there looking at the doctor, called another patient before me, and then they pass on a message. And anyhow, I saw him, and he just said, get to the hospital. And so I came out and I said to Margaret, I've got to go to the hospital. So I went down to the hospital, and I went into emergency, and immediately the doctor said, I know you. You came, you, and your wife was admitted, didn't you? I said, yes. So she immediately related to me. Then Margaret's surgeon came along. He said, what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be horizontal. And that worked in beautifully. And then he said, let me have a look. And he said, okay, I'll operate this afternoon. And I couldn't believe there was just a lovely flow of events which had me having an operation by 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon, which all started one lovely thing after another. I think we've got to be careful of over-selecting examples, but that was a highlight for me of things just nicely following on. Okay, so I just wanted to highlight with you this idea of the stream of providence. And if you want it in other places, if you're looking for it, it's in Arcana Celestia 6474 and 8478. Now, earlier today, before lunch, we talked about who was it, the evils being removed to the circumference, not being washed away. You have a look in Divine Providence 279 and 283. 279 and 283. And one of the teachings that I really, really love is where it is said, if we could but see the tiniest fraction of what the Lord does, we would be amazed. Divine Providence 202 and 332. And from years ago, this meant a lot to me. Divine Providence 278 is talking about repentance and the effort we need to make with the Lord to overcome and move on from our evils. And this, in this particular translation, says, well, even if you can't do it wholeheartedly, and I love that because I couldn't, still you can exercise restraint upon it. So that's when I fill my covers up with those little quotes like that which jump out at me and mean a tremendous lot to me.
Yeah. What in the book?
Well, I needed it at the time because I wasn't too wholehearted. Now, I want to move on now to the way in which the Lord is arranging and governs things. Where the book, The Power, Proving God, came so importantly to me is with regard to my understanding of the laws of divine providence and the fact that the Lord can't change who he is in the pursuit of his objectives. And what I've done this time is I've got you a handout sheet here, the 5 laws of the divine providence as reworded by Bruce Henderson in this book of his, Why Does God Let It Happen? Darren, would you like to read this verse, mate, this page? The five laws of the divine providence, as reworded by Bruce Henderson in his book, Why Does God Let It Happen? The first law is that God allows evil to exist for the sake of our freedom. We must be in a state of equilibrium between good and evil, heaven and hell, to be free to choose the quality of our lives. Without that freedom, we would not feel life to be our own. The second law is that we must be free to act from our own will, as long as we are making rational choices. Swedenborg says that people cannot be reformed if they are in states of fear, disease, insanity or ignorance, when they aren't able to make informed, rational decisions. But as long as we are of sound mind and body, we must be free to choose, even if what we choose is not what God wants for us. The third law is that we should not be compelled to believe in God, in his providence, or in anything compulsion takes away from, in anything because compulsion takes away freedom. Puppets and robots don't have freedom. Wars have been fought to suppress freedom or to win it, including the freedom to believe as we choose and live accordingly. No one wants to be coerced. God wants for us to make good choices, but he will not, cannot force us to do so. God's will is that each and every one of us gets to heaven by making good choices, by actually choosing heaven in the way we lead our lives. But he will leave people free to reject him, to embrace evil, and to choose hell. The fourth law is that for us to be truly free, we must be able to see and recognise evil in order to reject it. This is the challenge of freedom. Our culture is a smorgasbord of good and bad choices. We know what it's like to be tempted, but we also know what the healthy choices are, and we know what it is to live with the consequences of good and bad choices. The fifth law is that the operation of divine providence should never be evident to us, but that we should always know that it is working in our lives. Imagine if you could know how God was leading you. You would feel your freedom was threatened and probably would want to rebel, especially if God was trying to lead you out of a destructive habit while you were still enjoying it and not ready to give it up. We may get glimpses of providence at work when we look back over a chain of events, but not while it is happening.
Nicely worded, aren't
they?
Yes, it's plain English, and it humanises just a little bit from the book. Okay, any comment on that or on anything that's been said so far?
Is it in divine providence where we were reading recently where that fifth law at the end there, it's got, we may get glimpses of providence at work when we look back over a chain of events, where earlier on today we were reading about hiding in the rock and seeing the back of the Lord?
Yeah.
Is it in divine providence we were reading about that, where that was saying about... And that's related to that in Moses there that we were talking about earlier.
That in Moses was in Arcana.
Yeah, no, but that is related though.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Any other comments or thoughts about providence, the Lord governing human affairs?
Ian, I'm just wondering, met that several people that I've talked to, they're outside the church, they say to me, how on earth could you believe in God if there's so much suffering and evil in the world? Have you got an easy way, a simple way of answering that?
Well,
there are several things I try to come back on. And one is that I ask people, I appeal to people for perspective, because the perspective is unbalanced. It's unbalanced. The amount of evil and what is destructive and appalling that's happening is actually minute compared to the amount of good that's being done. When I see and hear, when I was in Brisbane, as other people were last year, and they appealed for people to come and help, I got in our car, and I got onto the Pacific Motorway, and it was crowded with
tradesmen, mainly tradesmen, and I couldn't believe it as I drove out of exit 40. There's a pedestrian overpass, and I looked up and I thought, what, where are all these people going? And now the actual of it was, I think between 27 and 30,000 people volunteered just that day with their brooms, brushes, gum boots and everything else to go in and really work in appalling, smelly, awful conditions to start the clean-up of the flood-affected areas of Brisbane. Now, that's 30,000 people, and tradesmen who probably could earn $75 to $100 an hour, plus the use of their vehicles, which they might charge, because they had dumps and trucks and bobcats and every conceivable earth-moving vehicle was on these backs of vehicles, all pouring into Brisbane that day. Now, I just ask people for perspective. I ask them, do you really stop to think? That's one thing. The other thing is I ask people to stop and reflect on their own life, the times when they have been cut off or nudged or moved from what would otherwise be a catastrophic or destructive course of action. And I find that very helpful personally to reflect on that. You know, the times when I might say something or do something and yet the Lord somehow seems to just move me away. But do maintain that the evil that does take place is minute compared to the good that is being done. And I don't judge the good. I'm not into natural good or anything else. I'm just thinking of people. I actually think it is heaven when people crowd the motorway to go in and slush around in 3 feet of mud. I think that's heaven working there. I don't think people stop to think they're going to be thought of as good people. I think they just got out there and did it. So, and then the third thing is you've got to stop and ask yourself, well, how much of what happens is caused by humans? I mean, the famines in Africa, the dreadful power, lust for power and war that's been going on in parts of the world, which have displaced people. We've now got refugee camps for tens of thousands of Syrians along the Turkish border. Why? Because you've got a megalomaniac running the place and there's an army supporting him and all this kind of thing. So why do we lay the blame of these things at God's feet when we ourselves should look at ourselves? Was it Ben? Yes, yes. I thought it was really Ben, you were talking about blame. Laughter shifted across to, you know, it's God's fault. You know, never mind what I might do to improve conditions around me and all that sort of thing. So that's. And the fourth thing I feel is useful, you said, and first brought to my attention by Peter Buss, when he first published the little book, Why Did the Lord Let It Happen? I don't know whether it's in this edition, but in a previous one, which is a longer one, he had a section on earthquakes and the so-called natural disasters. And he referred to a couple of paragraphs in Swedenborg's Spiritual Diary, which gave good support for what he was saying, that if you look at the animal world, they have a sensitivity to impending disaster. There's no question. You know about the elephants breaking their chains in Sri Lanka before the tsunami. And Peter went on to say, look, if you think about this, and he cited these paragraphs, which clearly indicate that with the externalizing of our lives, that's our human life, over the millennia since then, we have lost that sensitivity to impending change and disaster that the animals still have and which early man undoubtedly had. So, you know, there's a number of factors. Involved when it comes to people, you know, asking these questions about Look, I said to my mother the other day, I said, the news we get today is no different from what it was 25 years ago. Characters have changed, the countries have changed, but the disasters, the headlines, the fear and all that sort of thing, it's no different than what it was 25 years ago. I remember my father being riveted to the radio listening to something going on, Yellow Peril or something or other. Yeah, it's the same. It's the same evoking of attachment and emotion and fear. And it works. Because, again, Julian said in one of his newsletter articles, it was Romania or somewhere where the government ordered that 50% of the news be good news. And everybody turned off. They wanted to see the sensational news on some other channel. So we've got a hunger for, we seem to like to be in crisis. I think humans have a tendency to like to be in crisis. I don't know why.
We work more efficiently in crisis for some reason.
Yeah, in that sense of things. Go on, Patrick.
Well, I think it's, from my understanding, is that it's appropriate that it finds delight in injury to others. Just like Swedenborg describes the hells turning, you know, evil spirits turning against each other, that aspects of our program find their delight in the misfortune of others. Mm. I think reality television has a lot to answer for.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also, you know, those shows and movies and violence in movies. And,
no.
Actually, the population shift to the coasts was another, I think, a relatively modern coming on about port cities, but more ancient peoples lived more in land. I wonder if that's a reflection of externalisation as well, that you see a physical reflection.
Now, I wanted to just touch base with you on permission, there's another aspect of the book and of the teaching in the book, which is to do with determinism and predestination, which I'm taking up in a separate session. But I do want to just have a quick look at the subject of permission, which is a sizable portion of the book Divine Providence. One of the ladies, Marion, would you like to read this page on the subject of permission?
On the subject of permission, the so very important teaching when it comes to understanding the existence of evil. The Lord foresees and sees all things, and every individual thing, and He provides and arranges the same. Though some things arise from His permission, some from His concession, and some from His consent. Some from His good pleasure, and some from His will. The nature of the Lord's providence is such that it is linked together with foresight. The one does not exist without the other. For evil things are foreseen, but good ones are provided. And the evil things that are foreseen are constantly being turned towards what is good by means of the Lord's providence arrangement. Since the divine end, which has good in view, governs everything. Nothing is therefore allowed to happen except to the end that something good may come out of it. But because a person possesses freedom that enables him to reform, he is turned from evil towards good so far as he is freely allowed himself to be turned. He is constantly being turned from an utterly dreadful hell, which he makes every effort to cast himself into, to one that is not so bad, if he cannot be led to heaven. When the wicked suffer damnation and torment, the Lord's commission is not like that of one who desires what happens to them. It is like that of one who does not desire it, yet cannot help themselves, yet cannot help them, because his end in view, which is salvation of the entire human race, is urgent and prevents him from helping. For if he were to help, that would be doing evil, which is completely contrary to the divine. Peace holds within its trust in the Lord, the trust that he governs all things and provides all things, and that he leads towards an end that is good. There are no laws of permission by themselves or separate from the laws of divine providence. They are indeed the same. When, therefore, it is said that God permits, this does not mean that he wills, but that he cannot avert on account of the end, which is salvation. Whatever is done for the sake of the end, namely salvation, is according to the laws of the divine providence. For, as was said before, the divine providence, keeping this end continually in view, is constantly moving in ways different from and contrary to man's will. Therefore, at every moment of its operation, or at every step of its progress, when it perceives man to deviate from this end, it directs, bends, and disposes him in accordance with his laws by withdrawing him from evil and leading him to good. It will be seen in what follows that this cannot be done without committing evil. Moreover, nothing can be permitted without a cause, and such a cause is only to be found in some law of the divine providence, which explains why it is permitted. Divine providence 2:3-4, and from the beginning of chapter 8, the laws of permission are also laws of the divine providence.
Thank you very much for that. I just wanted to say this with regard to permission, I hope you noticed what was Marion was just reading there. Therefore, at every moment of its operation, at every step of its progress, when it perceives man to deviate from this end, it directs, bends, and disposes him in accordance with its laws by withdrawing him from evil and leading him to good. Now, when you come across this teaching of permission, the Lord permitting things because a greater end is at stake, when you come across this teaching of permission, you must never think that he kind of says, okay, then you've insisted on doing that, you better go off and do it. You might do, you know, you're 18-year-old, so they want to leave home, Dad, and you say, well, I don't think that's a good idea, but 3 months later they say, I'm going, so we're going to go. Off you go. Permission is not like that in the Lord's case. He permits, but he is closely involved in every step of what is happening. This is bending, restraining, nudging, appealing to conscience, appealing even to external factors which might act as a brake, like, well, what will people think of you if you do this? He's working with us every step of the way. And if ever you come across the definition of hell, that hell is the absence of God, it is not. The Lord is as present with people in hell as they allow him to be. And in fact, picking up on another of those statements there, if he were not present with people in evil, that's you and I, never mind about somebody else, if he were not present with us in our hellish states, we would tumble unrestrained into unbelievable ugliness and destructive behaviour. So, permission is not, okay, off you go. It's not like that at all. He's following us restraining and hoping that in some way or another he can avert the outcome. So here's another thing, for the things that do happen that are untoward and destructive, let's just say in our own lives, are just about nothing compared to what would happen if the Lord wasn't with us in this activity of holding us back and moving around, trying to get us to see better and more constructive responses to situations and so on. He never, ever gives up on that effort with us.
Would it be fair to say, like, so all permission is... all permission is granted in order to secure freedom.
It is, because he has to, otherwise he's going to interfere with that.
So any interference that we would naturally think should have occurred would have violated freedom and closed down the possibility for our salvation.
And be a worse evil. Which is what this said somewhere. It would be actually a worse thing, doing us a huge disservice.
We want him to interfere and help. We ask for it.
So the permission is for us to have our own freedom.
You're not going to learn to drive a car if you don't get behind the wheel.
So a permission is allowing us freedom.
Permission is good. Yeah, that's a very, very good definition. Permission is allowing us to have.
I mean, in the extreme situation of the death camps in the Second World War, when lots of Jewish people and rabbis were asking, where was God? Why didn't he provide for his people? Why didn't he, his divine providence change so that all these people could escape the horrors that he went through? This is to maintain freedom. Among the ones that you just said. In this case, the perpetrators of it, Hitler and his henchmen, their freedom came before what they did.
Can I just say that.
Their freedom of choice.
Yeah, can I just say that, and look, God forbid I would ever be in that situation. I really struggle with people who suffer in these unconscionable ways. I really do. And I haven't sort of easy answers, and I don't want to convey I have. But there's a couple of things I want to say. Hitler was only the top of a very ugly pile. There were 10 million Nazis, and some were worse than he was. Goebbels, for example. Mm-hmm. So if they had knocked out, if God had knocked out Hitler, there would have been others who would have done more rampant things. I'm not trying to minimise a thing. I'm just saying that's one of the. But also, look at Divine Providence 251, another key paragraph. 251. What happened through the Nazi behaviour? It wasn't just confined to them. That was the manifestation of something we all share. See, and that evil, post-last judgment, had to come to the surface to be seen by us all, not just that generation, but for generations to come. So, that evil, it's demonstrated to
partly
us.
Partly for our freedom now.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. And so the cost for people personally has been horrendous. The people who suffer.
I mean, there's something going on, you know, like, oh, obviously, but like the totalitarian, you know, you had Franco in Spain, you had communist Bolsheviks in Russia, you know, Stalin.
Roughly the same.
17 million people to their death. Yeah. You know, like, there was just some change going on in the spiritual world. It was massive.
But I have read that people that are in this suffering, their mind can be taken away from some of it, particularly children that are being abused. We imagine what they're going through, but I've read that they are actually taken over above it, so they don't really experience it as we think they are. It's not really quite so bad. We just imagine it would be horrendous. So maybe the Lord is holding them up in that particular way.
There's that protection of that innocence that is within them is right there. You know, you've got an adult mind. So I chat with one of our previous bosses, and one of her thing is about child molestation. They say, well, there is no God because of that. And you know, if you come to it from an adult with your own understanding of what is actually happening and put yourself in that position, it's replacing, you know, you're then experiencing that as opposed to, well, what is really happening in the mind of that child and of that perpetrator. You can't judge that. And it's very dangerous if we just start to do that. It's not a pretty picture, but it's you know, you can't talk it straight, but it's what's happening in reality, and the ultimate reality that we know or that we believe exists is different when you're living on a natural world and believe that this is what it is. It's a totally different scenario.
Just to finish, now I'd like to say that Glenn sent me a couple of emails. There's a two-part installment of a story from a black American, what's his name? You know the one you said?
Yeah, I know, but I don't remember your name.
Well, you remember how he ends up? He ends up by saying the curses of life are actually, for him, the blessings of life.
Mm.
He drove his mother to suicide and things like that, but looking back, he says these terrible events, actual fact, of blessings because of the way they brought him, you know, back to sort of sea life in ultimately a spiritual way. And so he didn't regret them in the sense that of what the good that had been brought out of them.
But that's really like saying like a child molestation. It's really an impersonal statement of saying, well, I've got to make a point for humanity. You, however, are on the short end of the example. So I don't have to get out of that one. Because it's not... Okay, you don't know what the child molested kid is thinking, but none of it is good.
No.
And I can't quite accept that it's... They're expendable for the sake of making a point for us later on, or the Holocaust, making a point. I can't quite grapple with that one at this point, because someone's got to suffer, and you can't. I don't think God lets, you know, it just says you've got the short straw, which I'm going to make a point for everyone else.
Yeah, I think we don't know what state we are in ourselves, let alone anyone else. So just taking it on a sort of random, typical thing, for one person to be poor and have no money is inconsequential. For another person, that is the end of the world. So the way that we, our internal spiritual strengths are different for everybody. Not in a way of spiritual advancement, but in where we have treasures laid up, for example. So we don't know how one thing is going to affect another person on a spiritual level. We may know it on a physical, natural level, but we don't know how that's going to affect on a spiritual level. And at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about the natural external level. The Lord's looking at our spiritual level, at what's going to lead us to heaven. Now, what we may see as something horrendous happening to us naturally may or may not be horrendous on that spiritual level, because it may be leading us to heaven. And if we can look at it from that point, I think it helps a long way towards what, you know, what the Lord is permitting.
The evil is a result of man's, the consequences of his actions and thoughts.
Yeah.
But then God can use it, as you said earlier on. God will use it for showing something for good in the future. He doesn't allow...
Can I just also say, in addition to what Helen
you're not just using it on the basis you've got the short straw there. I didn't make a point here, simply. He is primarily interested in that child, what he can do to then bring something that's good out of that for the eternal benefit of that child. I know somebody, and I know you lost a child, yes? I know its failures. But what has the Lord done with them over the years since that's happened to make them what they are today, or to help them to be what they are today? And it's quite remarkable. So what I'm getting at is, I don't believe the Lord uses other situations, first of all, for our lessons he may use on others. I think his prime concern always is with the individual person. That goes back to what I said this morning. When you're reading anything in divine revelation, it's about you. He's only interested in you, humble. He's only interested in that child who's been molested or whatever's happened to him. There's where his all-consuming compassion and love and care is. It's only secondary that it comes out of it, that the community is awakened to the terribleness of child molestation. That's second to what he's doing with the child.
I was abused as a child, okay? So, and at that time I was going through the abuse, so that was the norm. Yeah? I didn't know any different. But then I had a cousin that was married, that was older. Whenever I got kicked out of school because my hair wasn't braided due to the abuse, I went to my cousin. And then she would be crying, and other people would be crying. But I couldn't understand why they're crying. Because they could see, because I was telling them what I was going through. So they could see what I was going through. They were feeling for me, they were crying for me. But for me, I wasn't crying. For me, it was my normal life. But later, even up till last April, last month, I was still crying about it. I was still breaking down and crying. Until I spoke to my sister and I said, I explained to her what was going on. And she said, sis, you're depressed. I said, don't ever use that word on me. I said, don't ever use that word on me. Because I saw depression as something like clinical depression. Mm-hmm. It's for other people that are cuckoos. You know? I didn't know we could go into states of depression like in and out until I got that from somewhere. Someone explained to me, you know. And then now I can deal with it better upon that. You know? But like Helmut was saying, you know, the kids. At that time, the kids are going through that. They don't really know what they're going through. But now I understand that the person that didn't know what they were doing to me, that's what was explained to me. They were only acting what they knew. And they said to me, well, Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing, so I have to go with that. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, so that's what I'm going with now. But at the same time, what did you last say?
That the Lord primarily is focused on the person of themselves.
So with all the abuse that I went through, now I seem to be one person in the family that's sort of bringing the family together.
Isn't that interesting?
No. And then I'm the holy adult.
Thanks.